Good afternoon, America. Welcome. This is Mark Levine. I am doing the first hour of the show, giving you the inside scoop from Washington every single Wednesday from now to the end of the year. And after that, possibly a little bit more. You'll find out about that soon. Hey, so I got the first hour to talk to you today. And then the second hour, I'm going to split with Leslie. And then you'll have her by herself in the last hour. So whether you like her, you like me, you like both of us, there's plenty to talk about. Today, two main topics. The first has to do with still picking up the crumbs from the floor of 2014. Want to know why happened? We had the lowest turnout. We Americans voted less in 2014 than at any time since they first started recording the participation in American elections following World War II. Why was participation so low? And particularly, why didn't Democrats vote? Well, I would argue there's two main reasons for that. The first is going to be talked about by my guest, economist Robert Shapiro, who'll be on after the break, talking about still problems in our economy. We have a record economy, the stock market's at a record high, growth is at a record growth, but wage inflation, ordinary Americans' median wages have not increased. The rich have gotten richer. The middle class is struggling to stay where it is. And we'll be talking about why that is with economist Robert Shapiro. I'll give you a hint. President Obama's policies to help the rich were agreed on by Republicans. They became law, and they did help the rich prosper, help the economy prosper. President Obama's policies to help middle class, working class people, to help people in unions, to increase the minimum wage, to build infrastructure, which is good construction jobs, to basically help ordinary middle-class jobs, were not agreed to by Republicans. And so middle-class people didn't feel the benefit. And the shocking thing is that because middle-class people did not get what Obama wanted them to get, because Republicans prevented that from happening because of the obstruction in 2010, they blamed Obama and voted for Republicans. I'm trying to think of a way to explain this. Let's say you've got a let's say you've got somebody. I gotta think of the right analogy here, and I'm doing it on the fly. Let's say you've got a somebody pushing you down a sled, say down the slope. You want to get to the bottom, and you got a guy pushing you as hard as he can. And then you've got three guys in front of you who are pushing the sled back so you can't go forward, all right? And they push, and the guy in the back's trying really hard to push you, and you know his name, and he's really trying to help, and the three guys in the front, and they're not letting you go anywhere. It'd be kind of like saying, all right, guy in the back, you're fired. I got no forward movement. You three guys who are obstructing my progress, you're in charge now. And if that seems counterintuitive, well, that's what happened in the electorate. Now, it may be because many working class people weren't aware that President Obama was trying to help the economy for them and weren't aware the Republicans were trying to obstruct them. Indeed, that Republican policies caused increases in taxes at the state and local level, while President Obama would have decreased taxes. You don't often think of Republicans as the party of tax increases. But because they cut federal aid to the states, and that's how states get a lot of their money today. Most of our taxes go to the federal government, and then it goes to the states. By cutting that, they required states to increase their taxes to balance their budgets, because states have to do so. And in effect, the Republicans increased your taxes, and particularly increased taxes on working class and middle class people, while President Obama wanted to lower them. Now, I agree the president explained this very well, and neither did most of the Democrats running in Congress. And it didn't help that there was a whole bunch of red states where most of the Senate races were held. We'll talk about that in a bit. But basically, voters decided to vote out the guy that was trying to help them and in turn vote in the people that were trying to destroy them. And that's how you explain 2014. What? Yeah, that's how you explain 2014. Now, Robert Shapiro is going to be on after the break, and he's going to talk a little bit more about this. I don't know. I don't know his views. I mean, I'll ask him. This is a very incredible economist. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton, to Hillary Clinton, to Barack Obama. He's been around a long time. He's Undersecretary of Economic Affairs under Bill Clinton. Very smart guy. I'm going to propose my theory to him and see whether he agrees. But there's another reason why voting was low and why so few Democrats voted. And that's because Republicans intentionally threw away the voting registrations of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Democratic voters. They basically told Democrats, sorry, you can't vote this year. Now, how can they do that? Well, it's not an exact process. You may remember the Jim Crow era, they couldn't quite say you can't vote because you're black. They said you can't vote because you haven't paid the poll tax, or because you cannot read the entire Constitution and tell me what all its legal provisions mean. Oh, you don't know what ex post facto law is? Sorry, you can't vote. And when the black guy points to the white guy, who also doesn't know what ex post facto means, but they're letting him vote, they say, oh, he can vote because his grandfather was a citizen. That, by the way, is where we got the term grandfather clause. So the poor white Southerner can vote. His grandfather was a citizen. The poor black Southerner can't vote. His grandfather was not a citizen. His grandfather was a slave. So it's not because you're black that you can't vote. It's only because your grandfather was a slave. Got it? Well, that was the law in America for 100 years after the Civil War, until the Great Voting Rights Act of 1965 finally allowed African Americans to vote. Now, the United States Supreme Court has declared that law, the law that guaranteed African Americans the right to vote in America, based on, after all, the 13th Amendment to the the 15th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which guarantees the right to vote to everyone, even if you were once a slave, which exists because we fought a brutal civil war, the most bloody war in American history. By the way, more Americans to this day died in the Civil War than all of our other wars combined. It was that bloody. Yes, and that includes World War II and some of the other really bloody wars that you can imagine. Well, basically, the Supreme Court said, racism's over. Don't worry about it. Alabama isn't racist anymore. Texas, North Carolina, they love black people now. And so,
idiot.
Yeah, so that law that worked, by the way, I mean, what Lyndon Johnson had to go through twisting arms to get that law, what Martin Luther King had to go through, if you've seen the 1960s documentary, what the Civil Rights Movement had to go through, beating and dogs and the March on Pettus Bridge and the March on Washington and the sit-ins and the murders that people had to undergo to get these freedoms. And now the Supreme Court says, yeah, don't worry about it. And as soon as they said, don't worry about it, guess what happened? North Carolina and Georgia and Texas threw hundreds of thousands of blacks off the rolls. Now, the way they did it, they couldn't quite say, sorry, you're black, you can't vote. What they basically said is, let's see who votes for the Democratic Party. Oh, blacks vote for the Democratic Party. Poor people often vote for the Democratic Party. Young people often vote for the Democratic Party. Let's try to make it as hard as possible for all of them to vote. Let's require picture IDs. And let's make those picture IDs really hard to get. For young people, if you're in college, you can't get one, because educated young people tend to vote Democratic more than uneducated young people. So if you're we want you to go to college, we just don't want you to vote. Which, by the way, also violates the 26th Amendment to the Constitution, the one guaranteeing the right to vote to anyone 18 years of old or older. African Americans often don't have driver's licenses, particularly poor people often don't have driver's licenses. And those photo IDs can be hard to get. Guy worked in my campaign. Many of you know I ran for Congress in June. Young man worked in my campaign, did not have a photo ID. I wrote him a check. He'd done good work. I wanted to pay him for his work. He still has not cashed that check. I wrote him in May. Why hasn't he cashed the check? He doesn't have a photo ID. Well, why doesn't he just go get one? Well, according to the Maryland authorities who would give him an ID, he must have a valid birth certificate. Well, why doesn't he just get that? Well, in order to get a valid birth certificate in America, you need, wait for it, a photo ID. See, he could get that birth certificate. He just needs to present his photo ID. How does he get a photo ID? Just present the birth certificate. and you have neither of those, you can always give a passport. How do you get a passport? You got to have a birth certificate and a photo ID. Now, this guy was born in the United States of America. He has a Social Security card. He knows what hospital he was born in. There are records of his birth. Because he can't prove who he says he is, and don't ever lose your photo ID or your birth certificate, people. Because he can't prove who he says he is, he cannot legally get a job in America. He's going to have to go, and he's basically living from place to place. He doesn't have a permanent address, as many poor people don't. And I was thinking back to how I got my first photo ID, my first driver's license when I was 16, and I had a birth certificate. How did I have a birth certificate? My parents had saved it. But what if you don't have parents? What if your parents are poor and aren't saving documents? What if someone steals your documents because you're homeless and you don't have a permanent place to put them? Does that mean that you have no right to vote in America? Apparently so. And Republicans want it that way. And if you don't believe me that Republicans removing voters from the voting rolls was one of the big causes of having so few Democrats vote in 2014, I remind you that the margin of difference in North Carolina was within the margin of the number of people North Carolina refused to allow to vote. Think civil rights is over and 50-year-old news? Nope. It hasn't been won yet. The Republicans can't win by their policies, but they will win by denying you the right to vote. We'll talk about this and all these things with my guest, Robert Shapiro, after the break, former Undersecretary of Economic Affairs. If you want to call in and join the discussion, I encourage you to do that. The toll-free number is 888-653-7543. Right back after this. Show. This is Mark Levine giving you the inside scoop from Washington. My guest, Robert Shapiro, has given the inside scoop to some of the leaders of the country and certainly of the Democratic Party for about two decades. His name is Robert Shapiro. He was Undersecretary of Economic Affairs in the Bill Clinton administration. I think, Robert, did I get that right?
Sure, close enough.
All right. I didn't want to mangle your title there. He's also been advisor to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and many others. Robert, before the break, before you came on, I was talking about my own theories as to why the turnout in 2014 was the lowest turnout since these things started being recorded in World War II. 36%, two-thirds of Americans did not vote in the midterms. And of course, it was particularly low among Democrats. I gave my theories, but I don't want to in any way influence you. I want to hear your theories, and then we'll talk about where we agree or disagree. What are your theories as to why one turnout was so low, and then why specifically Democratic turnout was so low?
Well, I think in general, turnout was low. Look, let's begin recognizing that turnout is often low in midterm elections.
Sure.
This was a little lower than average, but not radically lower than average. Second, neither party gave its voters much of a reason to get out and vote other than to stop the other guy. There was very little positive agenda in this election. And that's, the negative approach motivates the true believers, but not many others.
Well, let me stop you right there before I go on to other theories. Politics have been negative, you could say ever since John Adams and Thomas Jefferson tried to tear each other apart in 1800. But certainly in my lifetime, it seems that they get increasingly negative. You see fewer and fewer positive ads, more negative ads. You see lots of these corporations who are putting secret money in to make really, really negative ads. Is this any more negative than 2012, 2010? I mean, those seem to be really
sure.
negative years as well.
No, I think it is, because at least in 2012, first of all, the president had a program that he talked about. Even Romney had a program he talked about. And in 2010, there was a central issue, and that was Obamacare. If and the Democrats made, some of them made the case for it, and the Republicans made the case against it. This one, I'm not thinking so much of the ads. I'm thinking of the fact that there was no positive Democratic or Republican theme. What will we do with control of Congress? There was no,
Well, I think
reform, create universal health care. There
right.
was no cut taxes.
To be fair, they'd have to kind of lie to voters, though, because control of the Senate, although political pundits like myself bloviate about things like that, at the end of the day, unless you've got 60 votes in the Senate and a majority of the House and the President of the United States, the party committed to obstruction can usually do a pretty good job, and I'm not quite sure that Republican obstruction from 2010 to 2014 will differ so much from Republican obstruction from 2014 to 2016.
Well, I don't think it will either. I think there may be a couple issues that they want to actually succeed on, but in order to create some record. But I have to say, I've come to the view that that's really a failure of both parties. Partisanship was just as strong and sharp-edged in the 1980s and 1990s as it is today. And yet, Reagan managed to bring enough Democrats over to pass important legislation, and Clinton managed to bring enough Republicans over to pass important legislation. And
so it
frankly,
sounds like you're criticizing President Obama a bit, are you?
Pardon me?
Are you criticizing? Whose fault is it? Is it President Obama's fault, Republicans' fault, both of their faults?
Both their faults.
Well, how is it that Reagan and Clinton could deal with Democrats and Republicans respectively, and President Obama's having such a hard time?
Reagan and Clinton had greater Washington political talent than the president. I don't think there's anyone in Washington who doesn't agree with that. I don't think there's anyone in the White House who doesn't agree with that. The president has other talents, but the ability to manage the political environment in Washington in such a way that you significantly raise the cost for a number of members of the other party to go along with you. That was an ability that Bill Clinton had and Ronald Reagan had.
No question about it.
George W. Bush didn't have it, and neither does the president.
I couldn't agree with you more, Robert. I got to take a break, and I want to encourage people to call in at 888-653-7543. Bill Clinton was the master, no question. So was Ronald Reagan. What's wrong, Obama? We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. My guest, Robert Shapiro, worked for, I would argue, the greatest Democratic politician alive. I would argue the greatest politician alive, Bill Clinton, who certainly faced a hostile Congress and still managed to get many important things through. He argues that President Obama just doesn't have those skills. And that's
now,
one
let me
reason.
Say
All right.
that
you get to backtrack
president
a little?
Is not the only one.
Right.
Responsible here. We also have a unusually ideological faction with sufficient power to overturn the Speaker of the House.
That the Tea Party.
Control the agenda of the Speaker of the House. Newt Gingrich was certainly, he was certainly in the 90s, seemed pretty extreme to all of us. But he was committed to getting some things done. And this ideological faction in the House is committed to minimizing government. So the less government does, the better from their point of view. So I was not saying it was simply the president. The president, look, but this has never been seen as one of the president's great skills. He has other skills.
Well, let me ask you this. In 2010, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, famously said when asked what his agenda was, what he wanted to accomplish in Congress, and they gave him choices of, low taxes or less regulation or whatever things Republicans like. And he said the single most important thing on his agenda was making sure President Obama would be a one-term president. He made it clear that obstruction was his goal, and that was something he felt he could achieve. And he even made clear that he felt that obstruction and gridlock would cause the American people to turn against the president. Sounds to me like he was a bit of a prophet in that regard. Why did no one blame the Republicans, it seems, for that entire strategy? And was there a way for the Democrats to use that statement by McConnell against him in 2014?
Right. But that's just a political failure on the part of the Democrats.
What should they have done, in your view?
That they were not able to make that case.
Well, what should they have done?
In a credible way. Look, it's not simply a matter of stating it. It's a matter of illustrating it time and again in a way that the public cares about. And the administration and the leadership in Congress just haven't done that. I'm always surprised. Look, I am a committed Democrat and progressive, and I am always surprised when I speak to conservative Republican friends of mine who see our side just the way we see theirs, as obstructionist and out to destroy the other side.
Well, here's the thing. We obstruct their agenda.
That's honestly how they see the Democrats.
Well, here's the thing. We obstruct their agenda, and we like that. We think we should. Their agenda is pretty bad, and it's according to us. And they obstruct our agenda for the same reasons. One of the things I've always wondered about, though, is why we couldn't just do good old-fashioned horse trading. For example, the Senate passed an immigration bill. It's a bipartisan immigration bill. It had, I think, more than 70 votes, definitely more than the filibuster. It's actually pretty harsh. It's not exactly amnesty. It takes 13 or 14 years. But it was a reasonable compromise. Democrats want to see that go through the House. Boehner wasn't interested. Okay, conversely, Republicans want corporate tax reform. They want to decrease rates. Democrats are okay with decreasing rates as long as we make more corporations pay, because only one quarter of corporations pay. Why couldn't Boehner and Pelosi and McConnell and Reid sit down and say, and I'm just giving these two bills as an example, we will take your corporate tax reform on an up or down vote if you will do our immigration bill on up or down vote. And if the Democrats presented that and the Republicans said no, then it seems to me that Pelosi and Reid get up there, and Obama too, and say, we offered this deal, they said no, they're the obstructionists, not us.
Well, and that's what they would say at that moment, and then there would be, and the Republicans would say, no, they made unreasonable demands, they're the obstructionists. Look, these issues, though, I think there's a possibility, actually, you could get some compromise on corporate tax reform in the new Congress.
But that's just what they want.
That both sides share. They're still pretty far apart in how to pay for it. But it's a, I think it's possible there. I think it's possible that we could see trade deals approved.
Yeah, but those are both things that Republicans care about more than Democrats, to be fair.
Yes, yes, but they're things the administration cares about.
Right, right.
The administration has been pushing for both. I don't think immigration is an example, however, because immigration splits the Republican Party.
Right.
And the Republican Party is not going to bring to a vote anything that splits its caucus.
Robert, let me ask you about white working class voters, middle class voters. They turned very strongly against the Democrats, at least the ones that voted. To be fair, probably most of them stayed home. But the ones that voted for the Republicans. It seems to me, and I'm a progressive Democrat, I don't hide my bias, that President Obama was doing a lot of things to help working class people, everything from infrastructure, a lot of good construction jobs, to raising the minimum wage, to health care, which after all mostly helps people who are earning $40,000-$50,000 a year, you know, middle class, hardworking people. And yet, because our economy is doing great for rich people, the stock market's at record highs. The gross domestic product is booming 3% or so a year. The dollar is going through the roof. The other economies are falling apart in Europe and China and Japan. We're doing the best. The only thing that isn't happening in America is income inequality. And if anyone's trying to fix that, it's the Democrats. The Republicans are obstructing it. And yet, economics and the economy was a large reason why many people said they voted Republican. Why the disconnect?
Well, let's step back and recognize that this is the fifth in a series of political wave or sweep elections. The Democrats swept in 2006, and then they swept again in 2008. The Republicans swept in 2010. The Democrats swept in 2012, and the Republicans have swept again in 2014. This is an unusually volatile electorate, and the volatility, in my view, may very well reflect the basic underlying issue of this whole period. And that is, if you look at what happened to household incomes as people aged through the 80s and 90s, you see that depending on the age group, you had steady, large gains in both cases. For example, if you look at people who were 25 to 29 in 1982, and 25 to 29 in 1991. And that group under Reagan in the 1980s, their incomes went up at an average annual rate of 4% a year, year after year, after inflation. In the 1990s under Clinton, they went up at 5.2% a year, year after year. And you see similar things for other age groups that virtually everyone, this is true of households headed by men, households headed by women, households headed by blacks, whites, Hispanics, households headed by those with high school diplomas and college graduates, less so for the high school dropouts, that everybody was making substantial gains year after year in their incomes in the 1980s and the 1990s.
So what happened?
And then it stops.
It stops under Bush.
Around 2002.
Okay.
And if you look at the youngest age cohort that was making 4 to 5% gains, it drops to under 2% under Bush and a little over 2% under Obama. You look at a little older age cohorts, people in there who began the last decade in their early 30s or began the 1980s in their 30s or the 1990s in their 30s, and their gains collapsed from 3% a year in the 80s and 90s to 0.1% a year under Bush.
I want to get all the explanation.
Actual losses.
Before we run out of time, what is the cause of this, in your view?
Well, I think there are a lot of causes. I think that the intensification of competition that has come with globalization puts pressure on businesses, and they are responding to it by cutting job creation and cutting wage increases. I think technology has a lot to do with it. You know, 60% of the country in the year 2000 lived in households headed by people who did not have college degrees.
So what policies
and their incomes have really collapsed over the last decade.
What policies?
So the question that people are asking
can help
all
us.
Of these elections is, why can't you bring back income growth?
Right. Can we?
Well, I think it would take a very serious set of policies to do so.
Give me some of those.
I think that we should give grants to community colleges so that anyone can walk in the evening and on weekends and get free training in information technologies. Make it universally free. The biggest problem are people without college degrees and older workers, those with the least IT skills. There are very, very, very few jobs in America today which don't require at least being comfortable in a workplace that's dense with these technologies.
And our high schools aren't teaching that enough.
Well, the high schools may be. Some of them are, some of them aren't. But we can't wait until those people at high school today
people need retraining.
The workforce.
Okay, so we need people in the 30s, 40s, 50s, maybe even their 60s, getting
Correct.
Some job retraining so there's not structural unemployment and leaving the workforce.
Correct. We
All right.
need to probably shift some of the cost of health care and pension. pensions off of businesses.
That would be universal health care, which Democrats also support.
Well, it's a that doesn't do much to reduce the cost for, you know, say General Motors.
Well, no, but no, if we had a true, and I hesitate to use the word single payer because some Tea Party may shoot me.
But I agree.
Medicare
I agree.
For all is the perhaps the better way to phrase it.
Right. From the point of view of, from an economic point of view, it doesn't really matter how you do it, just that you do it.
Okay. Two good policies. Now, President Obama certainly has said, and progressives have said, they support universal health care, or maybe they don't phrase it the best way. And many of them, many of you don't know, Robert, I ran for election right here in Northern Virginia in June, did not win the Democratic primary. One of the things I specifically talked about was making higher education free, subsidizing student loans, subsidizing college education, both for community colleges. So it's interesting that that's something that you pointed out, because that's something that I ran
right.
on.
Right. No, I actually, and I absolutely agree with you. I didn't say this, but I think that we need to make college tuition free for everyone in a who goes to a public institution within their own state.
I completely agree, and it's one of the things I talked about. But here's my question. These policies, which are seen as radically progressive, why don't they move the working class, particularly, let's face it, white working class voters who would most benefit from these policies?
Because they haven't been done yet. Look, the American people are very pragmatic and practical people. They're not generally set aside the kind of committed bases of the two parties and look at everybody else. They don't care how you do it. They just care that you do it. They don't care what the policies are that accelerate growth or income gains. They just care about the result.
Do you think if Senator Udall or Senator Hagan or any of the other senators who lost close races, had they advocated these things, would they have done better, or is it just not the year for Democrats?
Well, I think it was not going to be a great year for the Democrats, but it certainly didn't need to be as bad a year as it was. And one of the things that I didn't understand was why the Democratic Party and the White House did not mount a campaign that reminded people, look, things are not as good as we'd like them to be, but we did bring unemployment down from 10.5% to under 6%.
Exactly.
We have sustained much stronger growth and job creation than we saw in the Bush administration.
And if corporations have tons of cash and aren't spreading it, look to them. You know, that's not government's fault.
Well, I would have made it just a positive campaign about, look what we've achieved so far, and this is what we want to achieve in the next stage.
As FDR might have said, happy days are here again.
Well, or happy day
are coming.
Are coming.
Let me ask you this. We only got about a minute left. I do want to ask you about voter suppression. To what extent did voter ID laws in North Carolina, Texas, Georgia, and other states help keep down turnout and keep Democratic voters from voting?
Well, it certainly worries me in a state like North Carolina because the race was very close. Look, we know that there are concerted voter suppression efforts going on in almost half the states. And, you know, where it really, look, it matters as a matter of principle and civic virtue that the state is not an instrument for discrimination on the most basic right we have to vote, which is what's happening. In terms of outcomes, you know, it's got to be a close race.
Yeah,
look,
North Carolina,
I'm sure there was a lot of voters. I know there was
within the margin.
Told there was a lot of voter suppression in Texas, but even if there had been none, Wendy Davis still wouldn't have won.
Right. I think North Carolina was within the margin of voter suppression, and I'd like to see a new civil rights movement to remind us what happened 50 years ago, to have people march in and say, let us vote, and have sit-ins in voting places in telling people, let me vote or I'm sitting in all day. Maybe we need that kind of thing again. Thank you, Robert Shapiro, for a wonderful interview. Wish I had you for more time, but we'll talk again, I'm sure, in the future. All right, coming up next, we got the Talk Radio News Service. And Mark Levine, right back after this. Talk Radio News Service on line two. Victoria, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Tell me, Harry Reid says he's going to work with Republicans. Mitch McConnell says he's going to work with Democrats. President Obama says he's going to work with Congress. Everyone's singing Kumbaya. Do you believe it for a minute? Because I don't.
I don't believe it. I'll believe it for a minute. I won't believe it for very much longer.
Okay.
Harry Reid does want to get some things done in the lame duck session.
Sure.
So does Mitch McConnell. And there are a couple of old polls. They're capable of striking a deal, and they've got priorities. And in order to get their priorities through, they're going to have to make a deal. Mitch McConnell wants a clean slate for when he takes over.
So what's interesting is that it seems to me that nothing gets done in the 2 years after an election except for the last 2 months of the lame duck Congress. We saw that in 2008, 2010, 2012. I guess it'll be no different here. We'll actually see a burst of legislation in the next 2 months?
I think we'll see a couple of things. And they're only planning on staying until the week of December the 17th. And as soon as they get back today, which they are, they're planning to take off, of course, for Thanksgiving because they'll wear themselves out with this week's work.
So, yeah, 1 week is a lot for Congress.
It's a lot.
So what will they accomplish, do you think, between now and the end of the year?
Well, they're going to pass legislation to keep the government open. Whether they do it for a full year or whether they do a short-termer, I'm not sure. I think they'll provide new funds for the fight against ISIS. Whether they'll provide new funds for Ebola, for the fight against Ebola, I don't know. Some Republicans are saying that should be done in the new Congress.
Are they going to have a vote on the war? Because it seems to me that under the War Powers Act, President Obama has overstayed his legal authority. I mean, Congress, are they going to finally vote on this?
Well, he has requested some money, and so they are going to talk about that and whether they are going to do that. And also, they provided funds for him to train and equip the Syrian rebels in the
right.
ISIS fight.
Right.
Well, extending the authority for that is going to come up in about a month, and if they want to do that, they're going to have to sign off on that.
Okay. Real quick, because we only got like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
The Republicans don't like the U.S.-China climate deal?
Heck no!
Okay. Well, that answers that. Victoria, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Coming up in the next hour, I'll be talking with Leslie Marshall about the newest threat to the Affordable Care Act, to Obamacare, from the U.S. Supreme Court. You won't want to miss that right after this.
Happy Hump Day. I'm Leslie Marshall. Did you see that incredible, incredible saving of two lives by the New York Fire Department, the NYFD, some of America's finest, certainly New York's finest? First responders, that's why you got to pay them, folks, and pay them well. 59th floor of the New World Trade Center. Two window washers are on a scaffolding. Not one, but two cables break. The thing's like vertical. They're holding on. They have nothing to hold on to but the scaffolding. Because the New World Trade Center, the largest building in the United States, the tallest building in the United States, has all windows. It has no balconies, no ledges, no crevices, nothing they could hold on to. So all they could hold on to was the window washing little, what do you call that? Not a cart. You know what I'm talking about? The little crate they kind of work in. That was vertical and suspended by half of its normal cabling. 59 stories up. The New York Fire Department breaks the glass in the building. They were there, stuck there 2 hours, folks, because they were trying to figure out the best way and the safest way to get them. They tried to lower their own scaffolding. That wasn't going to work. Thankfully, there were not high winds. Instead, if there were high winds, it would have been a very different outcome. Those two men that were working on the scaffolding are alive, and that is thanks to, and no question, as a result of the great, fast response, quick thinking. And, you know, after a while, they were just like, we don't know how long this thing's going to hold, even though they had, they tried to cable it. It just was not secure because of the way that it was hanging off that building. They just punched, you know, they just cut out a window, and they showed, you know, that they cabled as much as they could. They wrapped cables around themselves, cables around them. Just absolutely incredible. You could see the apprehension of one of the men, and they took their time. You know, this doesn't go fast. This is a slow process because one wrong move and you got somebody who's going to fall 59 floors, and they're tied to you. They're going to take you with them. And the reason you tie them is because you have to have an anchor. And of course, I'm sure there's firefighters, you know, just incredible. 50 first responders responsible for saving two lives today in New York City. And this is just something that they do each and every day. And you know what? This is just another example where give them their damn money, their benefits, their pension. They deserve it. That's my opinion. I'm Leslie Marshall. Happy Wednesday. Happy hump day. And welcome or welcome back. Mark Levine sitting in for me on hour one, as he does each and every hump day on Wednesdays on the Only True Democracy and Talk Radio. And in hour two, we get to tango together as co-host Mark Levine, former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank and the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees. He is live in our nation's capital on the East Coast. I'm live in Los Angeles on the West. We're in both two blue areas, as little blue that is showing left on the map. Hey, Mark, how you doing? Happy hump day, and welcome back with me, co-hosting this hour with me. Love having you on as a co-host in hour two and flying solo in hour one on the show. Did you get to see what I was talking about? There's that incredible rescue?
I saw it before the rescue, and then I went on air, so I didn't get to see the actual result. I'm really glad to hear it came to a good conclusion.
Oh, most definitely. You know, and this is what amazes me. You'll have the Republicans talk about the bravery and the, you know, heroism, but when it comes to, you know, demonizing unions and not giving another dime to first responders, they're the first at the bat, up at bat, you know?
Yeah, they're heroes. We shouldn't pay them anything.
You know what?
Or give them health care.
Sarah Palin once said that if the Affordable Care Act passed, there would be death panels. Now, we know that's not true. With over 10 million people insured, that would not have been before. We know there are actual lives that have been saved, testimonies of people I'm sure that, Mark, you've met or spoken to, as I have. But now, Obamacare risks a death panel after all. But it's not people that will be affected immediately, rather legislation that then could, in fact, become a death panel for individuals who rely on this insurance for their health.
Right. And then that death panel, of course, is denying people wearing robes on the United States Supreme Court. We remember a couple years ago, the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, came to the United States Supreme Court and survived by a 5-4 decision. That decision was actually easy as a matter of law. All you had to do was say it was constitutional, and it's constitutional if it is either interstate commerce, and it's a sixth of the nation's economy, or it's a tax, and obviously they do tax people, or if it's for the general welfare, or if it's just necessary for some other great government goal. And even though it was very easy to find it constitutional, they barely found it. Chief Justice Roberts joined with the four liberals to save the Affordable Care Act. Now it's back on an even flimsier excuse. Basically, the thing is, in a 2,000-page statute, there was a typo made on one sentence on one page that it basically suggests that only the states can do these exchanges, when the entire rest of the statute, hundreds and hundreds of pages, says if states don't do it, the federal government can. And the question is, should this typo control? Now, all the lower courts have said, no, that's ridiculous. Of course, the typo shouldn't control. The Fourth Circuit said it shouldn't. The D.C. Circuit said it should. That was two very conservative judges, but that was overturned by the entire D.C. Circuit. So this is a case that the Supreme Court did not even have to take up. They didn't have to take it because the lower courts agree that the typo doesn't hold, but they did take it. It only takes four justices to take a case, and people are nervous. They're wondering what the Supreme Court is up to.
One of the things that I don't understand, you know, when I was a kid, and I think I told you I did a couple of semesters in law school, and I wanted to be an attorney at one time, never a judge. But I guess I had these rose-colored glasses on and this Pollyanna-esque idea of not only judges, but especially the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land. and how Lady Justice was blind, and justice was something that would balance the scales, and the Constitution was the reference manual, if you will, in order to make a determination how that balance would come to be. I've never in my entire life, Mark, seen a court so overtly political. Now, of course, there were left slants, but I mean, especially those on the right. And I question, you know, are these Supreme Court justices now bought and paid for? I mean, we know that Clarence Thomas's wife has been in, you know, bed with people that would actually help with this death spiral and this death panel. And
in monetary bed. I just want to, we're not talking.
And in monetary bed. Yeah. In monetary bed. Good luck if they want to sue us. We have good insurance and good attorneys. But seriously, the announcement that the Supreme Court would take up yet another challenge to the Affordable Care Act. We have two blows to the signature achievement of the Obama presidency. This is almost like the Supreme Court singing in unison now with, in January, what will be the majority of the House and the Senate, the GOP.
Well, a couple caveats. I don't think they're going to pull the trigger. I don't know. Chief Justice Roberts and I keep inviting him to come over for dinner. He never shows up. So I can't say that we're bosom buddies or anything like that. But all that being said, I still can't see how he would pull the trigger and destroy the president's signature act on a typo. I just don't see it. This case is even worse than the case that came up before. And as you recall, Chief Justice Roberts joined with the four liberals to uphold it. Now, to be clear, for the Supreme Court to take a case, it doesn't need five votes. It needs four votes. It needs five votes to decide. Five votes decides who wins the case. Five votes will decide whether Obamacare lasts or not. But only takes four to take it up. It may be the four conservatives took it up in the hopes they could persuade Chief Justice Roberts to switch sides. And so I still think he may hold firm.
How does this come about? How does this come about when there are things that haven't even reached the feet of the Supreme Court? You know, I mean, seriously, I mean, why do things like this get green-lighted when, you know, this is beyond minute. This is a typo. This is not a question of constitutionality, legality, right, overreach of the president and the executive branch of office.
Well, the four conservative justices do not like the Affordable Care Act. They don't think that poor people and working class people have a right to get health care. They think they should get sick and die. They're poor. They don't deserve to live. This is ideology, and you'll have to ask them why they believe it so strongly, but all it takes is four justices to hear a case.
No question about that. Now, these wealthy, right, leaning Supreme Court justices, along with Republicans in states and on a national level, want to get rid of this. If nothing else, they want to undo a legacy for the president. It's more political, isn't it? I mean, isn't it more political? It's not really financial. We haven't seen a huge sucking sound of money in the economy, as the GOP would have us believe, or of jobs lost. This is political. This would be to, ha-ha, you won, we cut you off at the legs.
Well, I also think it has to do, and Ted Cruz actually expressed this in an unguarded moment. He said that if we let them have this, they will like it and we'll never get rid of it afterwards. And largely that's what happened with Medicare and Social Security. Remember, Republicans opposed Medicare, they opposed Social Security, and lo and behold, now even Republican Americans, right, love Social Security and love Medicare. So they know that once this becomes part of something people are used to, the idea that you shouldn't go bankrupt or die just because you don't have health care, that the people are going to like it. And it's all about trying to cut it out and destroy it before people actually get to know it and like it.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more with my buddy, Mark Levine, who's my co-host every hour two, every hump day here on the Only True Democracy in Talk Radio, of, for, and by you, the people. We'll talk a little bit more about this, what it means, and also talk about the Affordable Care Act and why the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, does risk falling into a death spiral. And that death panel, unfortunately, could be our own Supreme Court of the United States. It will be before the court again. Like Mark says, he doesn't believe they're just going to, you know, cross this out over a typo. You want to join us? Pick up the phone and do so. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543 is the number. Pick up the phone and join us. Tweet us. Follow me on Twitter at Leslie Marshall. Follow Mark at Mark Levine Talk. And for emails, go to our website, LeslieMarshallShow.com. Click on Contact or Facebook, Facebook.com/TheLeslieMarshallShow to FB me. More with our co-host and you right after. We are back. I'm Leslie Marshall. Welcome. Welcome back. Only True Democracy in talk radio of for and by you, the people. Mark Levine is my co-host every hour, too, every Wednesday on this hump day. Happy hump day to all of you. Mark's in D.C. I'm in L.A. Mark, thanks for holding. Welcome back. My computer decided to do a little reconfiguring by itself, but as it's rebooting, because I did have a couple of emails, questions and comments I wanted to share, as well as some tweets. Speaking of, if you want to join us, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Our own Marky Mark executive producer had a question for Mark on this issue of the Supreme Court, this typo, the Affordable Care Act, and it would seem yet another another attempt at, you know, chipping away at this thing, or, you know, just, you know, replacing it, repealing it, annihilating it altogether. Marky Mark.
I had a two-part question. I know you and I had actually talked off-air about this, and you were very candid with what you think would happen and what should happen as far as citizens' reaction if the Supreme Court did, in fact, let this typo derail the Affordable Care Act. But before we even get to that point, do you think it was the same four justices who voted against the Affordable Care Act that accepted the case to hear it? I mean, is that the most likely scenario as how it got there?
You know, it's interesting. That's one of the things the Supreme Court doesn't tell you. They don't tell you which four voted. If they choose not to take a case.
Wait a minute, let me answer. Why? Because, I mean, seriously, even though the Supreme Court, highest court in the land, you know, they are. Technically, we are their subjects, so to speak, and pay their salaries.
Well, I think the reason is, and I guess I don't really particularly mind this rule. The idea is that the justices are supposed to sort of have a fair mind, and that the idea is that they're supposed to. I mean, we all know they don't. But the idea is that if it shows that they voted to hear a case, people might infer all kinds of things about how they're going to rule on the case. And remember, since it takes five to win, the four still have to win one over. Now, what's interesting, if the judges decide not to take a case, so let's say that six don't want to take a case and three do, those three justices, or even one justice who wants to take a case, can write a dissent to a denial of the petition. It's called petition for certiorari, but basically a petition to hear the case. If you want to hear the case and they won't let you, you can dissent and say that, you know, do you think this case should have been taken up? But when they do hear the cases, they don't say who the four justices are, and that's just the way they've done it for 2 years.
And as far as what I know, we only have 90 seconds here, but if you want to start to get into kind of A, how the law, if this happened, because I think it's important people know ahead of time, if they did strike it down because of this, what would happen? Because it's not just snap your fingers and Obamacare is gone. It's essentially they take the footing out from under it. Isn't that right, Mark?
Yeah, but I want to be clear. They put it out, they take it out from under about two-thirds of the states. Now, the one-third of states that still have their state-run exchanges will be okay. States like California, where Leslie is, D.C., where I host the show, will be okay. But states like Virginia, where I live, which has a Republican legislature and hasn't taken it, they will be knocked out. So it'll affect about two-thirds of Americans. It won't completely kill it, but it'll kill it for two-thirds.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're moving on to a different topic. Mark Levine's my co-host today and every hour two on Hump Day. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine. Follow us on Twitter at Leslie Marshall for me, at Mark Levine Talk for him. Pick up the phone and join us. If you have any questions or comments, I'll share a few of those comments when we return regarding the Supreme Court hearing the newest challenge to the Affordable Care Act right after this. Then we're going to move on to something else regarding the Supreme Court. And attacking Obamacare again. Don't go away. Hey, Hey, happy hump day. I'm Leslie Marshall. Welcome, welcome back. Only True Democracy and Talk Radio of for and by you, the people. I am your host, but on Wednesdays in Hour 2, I invite my buddy in Washington, D.C., Mark Levine, to co-host the show with me. He sits in for me. He's a former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank and the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees. Mark, thanks for holding. Welcome back, buddy. We have a couple of emails that, you know, before we move on. One that said in the subject, all the bad, this is from David, is yet to come. The mandate will slow GDP. What company will hire that 50th employee? The Cadillac tax will create a civil war with unions. Talk to us about this, because what I have seen so far is all of the, the boogeyman and the end of the world is coming with regard to the Affordable Care Act from the right, from the GOP, has not happened. The jobs have not decreased. We've had job growth. We have the lowest unemployment. The GDP has not slowed down. Everything that this guy said and that Republicans predicted is opposite financially. Hey, if nothing else, you may not like the president, but the economy is going in the right direction. It's stronger than it's ever been. Not ever.
Not only is the
in recent
economy
day.
Doing well, but the Affordable Care Act is doing amazingly well. We have the lowest rate of health care increases since these things have been recorded. We have more people having health care, a lower percentage of the uninsured than ever. It's costing less than the Congressional Budget Office said it would. Remember, the Republicans said, oh, the Congressional Budget Office, they don't know. It's going to cost way more than that. Actually, it costs less. It's brought money into the government. And basically, the only ways it's failing to cover as many people as it could is because Republicans in about half the states have prevented it from being implemented. Otherwise, yes, it could help a lot more people. So I would say all of the boogeyman judgments about it have completely come untrue.
I want to read another email here. Another email that says the key author of the bill said it was deliberate to push states into exchanges. Can you speak to us about that?
Sure. So there is this typo, and that's what they're talking about. There's this one portion of the bill where it says, talks about exchanges maintained by the state. Now, in about five other provisions of the bill, it talks about the fact that states can make these exchanges if they want to, and if not, there'll be a default federal exchange. This particular section didn't mention the default federal exchange. It's kind of like if you look, and I look at a lot of laws, being a constitutional lawyer, a lot of times laws refer to states, and if it's a federal law, it usually says states or D.C. because the District of Columbia is not a state. But every now and then, people in drafting forget the District of Columbia and they just put a state. Does that mean that the District of Columbia, for example, wouldn't have to pay taxes if it just says, each of the people of the 50 states pay taxes? No, they say we knew D.C. was included. It's that kind of thing. Whoever wrote that draft forgot to include the federal exchanges. And while that argument that the emailer made that, oh, they wanted to say states only to encourage people to the states to do this, that could have been in the statute. That could have been a way to draft it. But all these other sections mention the default federal exchanges. So basically, if it's written one way in one spot and 200 ways in another spot, are we to believe the one way is right? It's like I told Mark Grimaldi. I said if somebody's writing a letter all about him, a book about him, and one place they write his name Grimald, and the other 200 places they write Grimaldi, does that mean that the one place is right? Oh, the other 200 places are right.
You know, it's interesting. Generally, it's interesting you say this because I think, you know, Mark, I have two kids, one of which I adopted from Pakistan. And they didn't have a computer in the courthouse. They had the old Royal typewriter. And my husband, being more type A and more impatient than me, if you can imagine, which is a frightening thing that borders insanity, you know, he's sitting there watching this guy one figure at a time go like, chick, chick, chick. And every time he makes a mistake, putting on a very primitive form of whiteout. And my husband's like, let me type it. He goes, what? And he goes, let me type it. He goes, I'll get in trouble. And he's like, here's $20. Let me type it. Because my husband, like me, can type over 100 words per minute accurately. I think he could actually kick my butt even in typing. So anyway, he's sitting there and he's typing away. But it wasn't the first couple of pages. Well, this man had spelled my husband's last name wrong on the first page. And my husband spelled it right on all the other pages. Let's say 12 more pages.
Right.
And believe it or not, had to go back to court to get those couple of pages, and that was more of a delay. And this was, and I have the old one and the new one, and the old one, the improper one and the correct one. that those were the guardianship documents. So in other words, we couldn't get guardianship of our son in Pakistan, never mind adopt him until we got to the United States because of the damn typo and name change. So when you talked about that example with Mark, that's what it reminded me of.
Yeah, well, that's exactly.
But we're not right. Pakistan. We're not a third world country.
Legislation. You have to take account of all situations. This is a 2,000-page bill. It cross-references other parts of the bill. I've drafted legislation, and what happens is you write it one way, and then you change it. Maybe the federal exchanges weren't thought of originally, and then you have to fix it and correct the bill, and frankly, the clerks are supposed to do all that, but, you know, people make mistakes. And the idea that this legislation could be thrown out the window, and hundreds of thousands of Americans will lose their health care. Actually, it'll probably be closer to millions, will lose their health care, meaning that tens of thousands will die from lack of health care because someone made a typo and the Supreme Court upheld it. It's astonishing to even imagine, and it's why I think, hope and pray, that at the last minute, Chief Justice John Roberts will look back at the abyss and say, I don't want tens of thousands of people to die because I upheld a typo.
I wanted to ask you also, there was an email. I did want to just wrap this up in a bow with regard to the economy, which you and I agree has improved, and since the Affordable Care Act as well. Another email says that we have the lowest, regarding the economy, we have the lowest rate of growth at 2% of any recession in 100 years. Where do people get these types of figures? I mean, conservative blogs?
I don't know, because all you have to do is look at the Great Depression when we had unemployment in some places rivaling 25%, and we definitely had negative rates of growth for many years under Herbert Hoover. It is true that this recession is slower to come out of than some of the more recent recessions, the recession of 2001, the recession of the late 80s. And the reason is because it's financial recession. And financial recessions, like the Great Depression, mean that people can't find credit anywhere. In fact, the credit markets froze for the first time since the Great Depression, since all the banks closed and FDR had to have bank holidays and there were lines outside banks and stuff. And so those kinds of things, credit is the lifeblood of the economy. Without credit, very few businesses can function, and it always takes time to get out of that financial recession. But I'll say this. Europe was in the same financial recession. We started it. Wall Street started it, but it went to Europe. It went to Japan. It went to China. We are doing better than Europe, Japan, and China. Europe's about to undergo its third recession because it keeps practicing austerity, which in this country is known as deficit cutting. And they cut the deficit so much in Europe that they're undergoing their third recession. If it had not been for President Obama's stimulus package, we would be in far, far worse shape. And
right, because we'd be like, right, we'd be like EU2.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I want to ask you some questions. My crew had some questions they had as well, but one of theirs is very similar to mine. If the Supreme Court guts this, the majority of Americans, even Republicans, don't want this gutted, despite the outcome of the most recent election this past week. Are Republicans that stupid to have justices that they're obviously pulling the strings of to a degree leave millions of people without health care? And can that legally be done? I say that because whether it's gay marriage or even health care, isn't there any kind of a grandfather clause that protects those? For example, if you were born after the Affordable Care Act was passed and you had a terminal illness and you need medical care, or just a chronic illness and you have medical care, can that care, and I'm talking about the federal coverage now, I'm not talking about the expansion on the state level, we'll get to that. Can that coverage be ripped from you?
Well, as you said, if you live in one of the states like California, you'll be okay. But if you live in one of the states, which are two-thirds of the states, that have not put in their own exchange, sure, they can take that away. We have, I mean, you can go.
And would Republicans be so stupid? Because let's be honest, they would be real death panels, and that would kill the Republicans' chances of any kind of a victory in 2016. And we know they care about their elections and their asses and their political careers more than they do human lives.
I don't know. I don't know that Republicans care about poor middle-class people dying from lack of health care. I just don't know that they do. I don't see, remember, prior to the Affordable Care Act, for 50 years, we had tens of thousands of Americans die from inadequate insurance. They go to the emergency room, that's the only health care that a lot of working-class people have. I don't remember too many Republicans talking about. I don't remember Rand Paul, who's a doctor, talking about his heart going out. I remember Doctors Without Borders, which normally works in Africa and Latin America, third world countries, came to Knoxville, Tennessee, and opened up something there, and they had thousands and thousands of Americans turned away because they offered free health care for 2 days. And they were completely full to the brim, long, long, long lines. They only saw about 20% of people, and we're not Liberia. This was Tennessee. And so I don't know that Republicans would care very much. Remember, poor people don't pay their bills. The Koch brothers do, and I assure you the Koch brothers have good health care.
So if the Affordable Care Act is done away with in the states such as California, where I am, where you do have the Medicaid expansion, all those people, in a sense, would go on to Medicaid, right?
No, you'd be okay in California. I want to be very clear here. If you're in a state that has an exchange, California, they're mostly blue states, California, Oregon, Washington. There's a few red states like Kentucky that have it. About 16, 17 states in D.C., New York, D.C., Maryland.
Okay, so two-thirds of the majority of the country that don't have exchanges,
right.
Correct?
Right. The majority of the country would lose their subsidies for health insurance. They could go out and buy it on the market like they could before the Affordable Care Act, but if they can't afford it, they just lose it.
And it can be very confusing. So technically, you could live in one state and have insurance with a pre-existing condition, move to another. In other words, if you live in a blue if you're sick, flock to a blue state. Just in case. I'm not laughing at that totally. I'm laughing in disgust. We'll be back. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine, my co-host, every hour two on the only true democracy in talk radio. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Leslie Marshall. Happy Hump Day. Hour two on Hump Days. Wednesdays, Mark Levine joins me and my partner in crime co-host. He's in D.C. I'm in L.A. Mark, thanks for holding. Welcome back as my co-host on Hour 2 on this Wednesday. Let's take some calls. Going to Wisconsin, Line 2 with Brett. Hey, Brett. Good afternoon. Welcome. Happy Hump Day.
Hey, happy Hump Day. Good afternoon. I just wanted to say, I think that I don't know anybody, Democrat or Republican, who's 100%, satisfied with the so-called Obamacare, affordable health care. But to just scrap it and just completely get rid of it, that would be an even huger mess than what they already complained that it is, you know. And as someone that got screwed on the whole pre-existing condition thing when I got injured a few years ago, that's not the direction we need to go. And obviously the bill could use some reform in a number of places, but to just scrap it completely seems like a huge mistake. And it seems like it'd be a costly mistake if they're really concerned about money.
Brett, you raise a very good point. Mark, what do you think about that? Because when you're talking about price, there's the cost financially, but then there's the cost in voter currency, which can really hurt a politician in their career.
Well, I agree. There are a number of costs. For one thing, there's also the cost of certainty. We got used to this new system. Healthcare.gov works now. People have their health care. They're renewing it. And suddenly millions are going to lose their subsidies and have to find health care or go without insurance. I would think they'd march on Washington. Voter currency costs. It costs to companies who have plans. All these companies now suddenly they're going to have to find new insurance. You've got the cost to the country of just the expense of these things. You've got tax revenue that ceases coming in. It has a number of different fronts, which is why at the end of the day, and I sure hope I'm right in my prediction. I'm pretty good about predictions. I'm not always right, but I do predict that Chief Justice Robert will, unless I say, we'll see the abyss and pull back from it. But also because the legal argument's so stupid. If they had a solid legal argument based on the law or the Constitution or some ambiguous way of describing it, but it's a typo, for God's sake. And I think that would make people even angrier to know that they threw out this law because someone made a typographical error.
What do you think, Brett? You said basically, you can't meet one person that, really loves it. But you know what? I don't meet any. You just said, but to scrap it, .. I haven't met, except for politicians, one person that really just wants it scrapped. They may want one element scrapped, but I don't think there's anybody out there, except perhaps a Republican politician that could be so heartless that wants, a baby who right now, because of health insurance, is you know, in an incubator and alive, unplugged.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I can't say specific names, but I hear it all the time that we need to get rid of Obamacare and end Obamacare and the bureaucracy of Obamacare.
You can say names or in talk radio for crying out loud, but you don't have to.
Friends of his.
Yeah, I'm not thinking of any in particular. I'm just saying I hear it all the time, you know, and not just from politicians, but just from people in general. And you know, I started following your show through social networking. You know how social networking is. It's a mixed bag of the extremes, but, you know, I see it all the time. People, oh, we need to get rid of it, and it's a travesty, and it's a... But, you know, they're not looking at the fact that there's people like myself who went through medical stuff. I had cancer, I had back surgery, I had surgery on my neck, you know, I had issues, you know, and granted, it could always be worse. But, you know, if I wouldn't have had some sort of safety net for all that, you know, people go broke all the time just from getting sick. It's not because they're lazy. It's not because they want free money. You know, they get sick.
That's actually the major cause of bankruptcies in America. And, Brett, you sound like a pretty young guy. A lot of young people don't think they can get cancer. They think that they're, you know, invulnerable. And sounds like you hit the bad part of the lottery, but because of health care, you were able to be treated.
I got cancer at 37 years old, so.
Wow.
When I went to treatment, it was me and, you know, 10 90-year-old people all looking at me wondering what I was doing there.
Not a good time.
Let that be a lesson to young people. Get health insurance.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I had insurance, but this has nothing to do with the law. This is just bad timing on my part. But when I had the back injury, they got screwed on with the pre-existing condition thing. It was like maybe a year after that. So then I wasn't working and I didn't have insurance.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was quite the mess. But you know, eventually I was able to get help. I mean, and with the current system that we have now, I at least know that I have some sort of, you know what I mean? I'm not just left in the cold, you know. So
well,
these people that think they could just scrap it is ridiculous. I'm sorry?
As you say, if they take away your health insurance, I assume you'd be willing to join a march on Washington and tell them to put it back.
Absolutely. That wouldn't be the first time I have. So.
And you wouldn't be the only person standing there, that's for darn sure. Thank you for the call, Brett. Appreciate it. And best of luck to you, buddy. Sorry that's so young. You have so much going on. So, people with pre-existing conditions, if the Affordable Care Act is gutted by the Supreme Court, are screwed unless they're in a state that has an exchange, like California, and like you said, mostly blue states, a minority in our country, two-thirds of the states in our country don't have this. What can Americans do? I mean, when you have a politician running for office, when you have somebody's phone number, are Americans powerless when something's coming before the Supreme Court, Mark? Because the Supreme Court doesn't really seem to care about the court of public opinion, do they?
Well, I wonder about that. First of all, this is not a constitutional question. The Affordable Care Act is constitutional. This is a statutory question. Congress could tomorrow fix this typo. All they have to do is vote the same act, correct the typo, get it through the House and the Senate. President Obama would happily sign it, and we'd be fine. We have to remember that the Supreme Court will say, hey, you know, don't blame us. Congress can put this through. But obviously, the Republicans who control Congress do not want people with pre-existing conditions to get health care. And why? Now, what's interesting is they rarely put it that way. They'll say, oh, we want people with pre-existing conditions to get health care. We just have no... We have no ideas of our own about how to do it. They say they do, but they never put any on the table. And it's all about fooling Americans and convincing people that because the Affordable Care Act isn't perfect, and Brett's right, it's not perfect. I prefer universal health care myself that would cover everybody and wouldn't be tied to employment. I don't see why health care should be tied to employment. Do it the way they do it in Europe or Canada. So I don't think it's perfect either, but it's certainly a lot better for people like Brett who just called in than having no health insurance at all.
Last thing you want to say on this, we have a minute together. I'll give you the last word in this hour, buddy.
I would say this, that remember that actions from politicians have consequences. And when your friend or your politician says, I hate Obamacare, it's terrible, and all these things, say, what would you prefer? Would you prefer, give them the example of Brett, would you prefer that a 37-year-old with cancer just die? Is that what you prefer? You need an alternative. Just because something is imperfect doesn't mean it should be scrapped. The question is, what's the alternative? And Republicans won't give an alternative.
You're a good date, buddy, and I don't even have to sleep with you. I don't even have to sleep with you. You don't have to take me to dinner. It's great, isn't it? Mark Levine, my co-host every hour, too, on Wednesday here on the Only True Democracy in Talk Radio. Have a good one, buddy. Coming up, wide open telephones. What are we going to talk about? Well, I wrote about it in my weekly column for U.S. News and World Report. Maybe you could check it out on our website to get in line to talk about it now. LeslieMarshallShow.com. Pick up the phone. Join us, 888-6-Leslie. Back after this.